You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, a variety of corn that creates its own fertilizer. Sounds good, too good to be true, but researchers discovered some that have been cultivated by indigenous Mexican farmers for millennia. We'll talk with one UW researcher about how it works and what it could mean for production of America's largest crop.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Foxconn is hinting that plans for its manufacturing site in Racine County could be changing. Plus, a budget request for the UW system is causing disagreement at the state capitol.
Also, a recall election is set for the Trempealeau County District Attorney, and a historic high school football winning streak has come to an end.
Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Chris. Thanks.
So Foxconn, as you know, is in the early stages of constructing a manufacturing plant in the village of Mount Pleasant. But this week, statements from the company are leading to some uncertainty about what kind of plant we're going to potentially see there. What's going on with Foxconn?
So businesses' plans can change. This is obviously something that happens as they assess where they think their market is going to go. But, of course, most businesses are not getting $4 billion in various kinds of taxpayer aid. So this particular business gets particular scrutiny when it makes these statements. So you can get into the technical details pretty quickly, but sort of some of the details are pretty interesting. Well, long and short of it is the biggest and most expensive sort of factory is called Generation 10.5. These factories make the biggest types of screens, like for really big TVs. And according to the deals that Foxconn signed with Wisconsin, this is what the Wisconsin plant was going to build. But new public statements by company executive they're suggesting that actually, maybe that is not exactly what Foxconn needs at the moment. There are a bunch of new Chinese factories that would be competitors, and so instead they may make a factory that will make smaller screens, working with smaller sheets of glass. And, you know, this is considered a red flag to critics of the deal, who ask whether that might also mean fewer jobs.
Yeah, I know Foxconn was saying that maybe we're going to build this plant down the road. I think the Generation 10.5 is what it's being called. But they told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that it depends on the market and economic situations at the time. And that sounds kind of vague. And that probably isn't sitting too well with critics of Foxconn, including Democrats. What are we hearing?
Yeah, a couple of Democrats in the legislature held a press conference at the Capitol this week to ask for new numbers from Governor Scott Walker, and really to just kind of press the point that they are skeptical about this project. Foxconn's message is that it's still going to spend the same amount of money in Wisconsin. It's going to hold to its promised $10 billion investment. It says it will still create the same 13,000 jobs by 2023. What they're saying is that, well, we'll build this like less complex factory first, but this is a giant campus. We're always going to be building multiple facilities in this area, and so we could still do a Generation 10.5 factory in the next phase or something.
So I think the takeaway is, regardless of what the company does, they are going to be under a giant microscope from Democrats and other people in the legisature.
Yes, this is a fact. This is a fact. And just that one thing, I mean, just briefly, it is always worth saying that the taxpayer portion of this, much of it is not actually automatic. It is tied to specific outcomes. So if this company doesn't hit these certain revenue targets or hiring targets, it doesn't get the full $4 billion. So, I mean, there are some protections, but still, like, yeah, it's, as you say, it's going to be questioned at every stage here.
We're talking right now with Robert Menser. He is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And switching gears now, Rob, this week the University of Wisconsin system proposed its next two-year budget to state lawmakers. And as with any UW budget at this point with this legislature, it's causing some political friction, especially due to a proposed $107 million in new funding. And where would this funding go if approved?
Yeah, this is so the
UW budget is always contentious. It's a huge pot of state money, and it's the sort of thing that a lot of different groups or people who have different views are always fighting about. In this particular budget, this is a large dollar increase, a much larger requested increase than UW requested the last time around 2 years ago. And to answer your question, where it goes is basically to the STEM field, to science and technology, to these performance-based, sort of outcome-based measurements that the university is has been pushed to implement, and in general the viewpoint, I guess, is that this is a response to pressure from Governor Scott Walker and Republican lawmakers to make the UW system more like instrumental, more directly about training people for jobs.
And on that note, we heard from State Representative Katrina Shanklin. She's a Democrat from Portage County. She's against this proposal. Here's a little bit of what she had to say about it.
This seems like a pretty concerted effort from Republican legislators, Governor Walker, and the UW system to transform higher education so it's less focused on critical thinking.
And this comes after a decision earlier this year at UW-Stevens Point to eliminate more than a dozen majors, mostly in the liberal arts. UW-Superior had previously gone forward with a plan to eliminate majors as well. I'm wondering, when it comes to debating higher education in Wisconsin, is this going to be the big political debate going forward, being what is the purpose or what should be the purpose of a higher education?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not, as you point out, it is not coincidental. I don't think that that it's Representative Katrina Shanklin who was the voice for this, because the proposal in Stevens Point, where she represents, where her district is, the UWSP's proposal was quite dramatic to cut all those majors, history and English. That is the sort of the one pole of this debate. And I don't think anyone, there is an actual philosophical difference, I guess, the extent to which the UW system's funding should be tied to specific economic functions. I don't think anyone thinks that science and technology majors are bad, but there is a feeling among many, and you hear it from Democrats in the legislature, that that someone needs to defend the liberal arts as liberal arts. And that is that's where that part of the debate lies.
Another story that I want to get your take on, we're going to move to Western Wisconsin, where a Trempealeau County District Attorney is now going to be facing a recall election on October 2nd. What's going on there?
Yeah, I find this story kind of weird. I guess I don't know Trempealeau County very well, but the district attorney, Tavi McMahon, is subject to a recall election. It's going to be held in October, on October 2nd. So it seems to have started, or at least one factor is because some local police leaders have criticized McMahon as sometimes unprepared for court or prone to reduce charges and ignore the advice of police. That is according to reporting from the La Crosse Tribune. It's a bit hard to know exactly what to make of that. But then there's this other weird controversy, which is there was a funeral for a nearby Jackson County district attorney, and McMahon said that all employees, it was mandatory that they attend this guy's funeral. The office manager did not attend, and so he fired her. So she sued. That's still tied up in court. But that was a point of controversy there, and apparently was taken as just a sign of the guy's way of managing. There's going to be a recall election.
And there were over 3,000 signatures supporting McMahon's recall, and that was well over the amount needed for the election. And, I mean, I don't claim to know a whole lot about the politics of Trempealeau County, but does that strike you as a lot of political engagement for an issue involving a county DA?
It's a big number, and the county board there had called for his resignation before this effort went forward, and the controversy appears not to be going anywhere soon there. The day that an assistant DA there filed to run against him in the recall election, and the day that that assistant DA made that filing,
and fired that guy as well. So now that is yet another point of controversy in that race.
We'll be watching the situation there. And briefly, Rob, before we start to wrap up, I want to get your take on one last story, this one from the world of high school sports, which is football season is kind of kicking off here. And one Wisconsin high school team had a pretty impressive streak going on, and they lost it this week. Tell us about what happened with Kimberly High School.
Kimberly High School won 70 football games in a row. That's a lot of football games. Chris, it was before last Friday, they had not lost a football game since 2012. It was the longest active winning streak in the nation, and everybody's very really proud of the papermakers there. But they were beat by Fond du Lac, who had been a major rival in the course of that winning streak. Finally went over the top in the football season opener this year.
And Rob, just very briefly, Papermakers, good team name or best team name ever?
It's a good one. It's a good one. They're in the Fox Valley. You gotta I like it.
Well, Rob, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
Rob Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He was with us for our weekly look at news from around Wisconsin. You've heard that if something is too good to be true, it often probably is, but that doesn't appear to be the case when it comes to the, quote, almost outrageous findings of a particular kind of corn.
Researchers, including some from UW-Madison, have spent a decade studying the corn from southern Mexico. It turns out that this variety creates its own fertilizer and grows to a height of 16 feet.
With self-fertilizing corn, farmers wouldn't have to spend money on expensive fertilizer or worry about fertilizer runoff affecting water used for drinking, fishing, or swimming.
Jean-Michel Lanet is a professor of agronomy and bacteriology at UW-Madison. He's one of the researchers who's studying this variety of corn. Jean-Michel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So how did you first find out about this corn?
So the person who found that corn is Howard Shapiro, who works for the Mars Company. And Howard was interested in ancient varieties of corn that could have unusual properties. And he was surprised to see that giant corn growing on the slopes of the mountain with very little nitrogen and growing so well. So he conducted some first initial experiments and found that that corn was able to acquire a very significant amount of its nitrogen from the air, which is normally something that we see in legumes, not in cereals like corn. And so that's where he actually brought me on the project to try to confirm that result.
And so you started working on this project in 2010.
Correct.
When it was first brought to you, did you think this was even possible?
Not at all. Not at all. To be honest, we often think that sometimes we have some leads, but very, very rarely we get some such results. So the problem is that the nitrogen fixation is actually very difficult to measure, and there are different techniques, and they all have potential pitfalls. And so initially for the first years, we were more looking for the problem in Howard's data than really believing it was true. But technique after technique, we were getting the same results. So that's why it took us 8 years to really make sure that it was true. But that was actually fairly unusual.
So this variety of corn is growing in Oaxaca in southern Mexico. Tell us about the landscape where it grows.
So it grows in fairly high altitude on the slopes of the mountains of Oaxaca by the indigenous people, and that's their corn that they grow traditionally with traditional methods, and in particular they don't use any fertilizer over there, which was the surprising thing. Another particularity of that climate, it's fairly humid and rainy, and we found that the trait depends quite a lot on rain frequency in particular. Mm-hmm. We found that ideally you need to have rain every 2 or 3 days to really maximize that process of that we call nitrogen fixation.
Hmm. So a very different landscape than, for instance, Wisconsin corn is growing in.
In fact, we run experiments that are not published yet in Wisconsin, and we found fairly high rates of fixation even in Wisconsin. Mm. As you probably noticed, we have fairly humid and rainy summers, and that actually allowed really good rates of nitrogen fixation even in Wisconsin. With collaborators, we also did experiments in California, and over there, basically, there was no fixation. It's too dry. So the trait depends on humidity and rain frequency, but I do believe that there's a potential for that trait in the Midwest.
So as we said, this corn grows to about 16 feet tall. So I'm sure that's the first thing you noticed when you saw it. But when you looked at it more closely, you noticed some characteristics on the corn plant itself that are very different and that are tied to this nitrogen fixation. Tell us what it is about this corn that looks different and behaves differently.
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't think that the trait of nitrogen fixation is linked to the size of the corn. That corn is unusual also because it's covered with roots on the stem, on the stalk. And many people have noticed that in the typical corn that we grow here, we have two or three nodes with such what we call brace roots. But the corn from the Sierra Mije is literally covered with roots. It has roots up to 8 to 10 nodes. And so that's one surprising feature. And the other feature is that after rain, these roots produce a gel, and a lot of gel. So people here maybe notice that on their brace roots, they may have a little bit of gel. But the corn from Sierra Mije produces milliliters of gel, like covered with gel, which is something that we had never seen before in corn. And what we found is that the process of nitrogen fixation, which is done by bacteria, happens inside of that gel. And basically, the more gel is produced, the more fixation happens.
So is there bacteria living inside the gel?
Correct.
That what's happening? And so how is the nitrogen getting from the air into a form that the corn can use?
So the bacteria are basically the only ones that can do that process of converting nitrogen from the air into ammonium. The process after on how the nitrogen is transferred from the bacteria to the plant, we think that it's in particular in the form of ammonium itself, but we're also looking into other possibilities. In particular, there is a process of drying of that gel on the root, and we're wondering also if that process of production of gel followed by the gel drying on the root over during the following days also could help in releasing that ammonium to the plant.
We're talking with Jean-Michel Annet. He's a professor in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. He's an expert in plant biotechnology and molecular biology, genetics, and symbiosis. And we are talking about an incredible species of corn that grows in Oaxaca, Mexico, and is self-fertilizing. Now, Jean-Michel, you talked about the fact in an article that farmers in this area actually collect the gel that is on these kind of aerial roots and keep the gel in jars. What do they do with that?
So they confer some mystical properties to the gel. The point is that clearly these indigenous community noticed that the gel matters, and they, of course, did not know about nitrogen fixation. They did not know why, but clearly that trait was improved and bred by the native people, probably because they simply noticed that the more gel their corn was producing, the better it was growing. And I think we really need to give them credit for recognizing the trait and for probably over many generations improving that trait in that corn.
And do we know how long they have been growing and improving this particular variety of corn?
That's a great question. To be honest, I don't know. There are other people in the group who are more interested in the more social and cultural mm-hmm. aspect of that corn. In particular, several people from our group stayed in Sierra Mije for several years and basically to study their culture and how that connects to their corn. And in particular, a book was developed, which is both in Spanish and in Mije, which is their native language, talking about biology and in particular the importance of their corn to explain them the more biological components of their that supports their corn.
It sounds like this model of going and actually spending extended times with the people who have cultivated this corn is happily a different model than has often happened when outsiders have come in and discovered indigenous knowledge and materials. What has it been like working with this community, and what steps have been taken to make sure that they benefit from this?
Sure. So first, personally, I did not go there to Sierra Mije, but Alan Bennett and Howard Shapiro have been there, and several students on the project have been there. I think one important aspect is, again, to give them credit for what they have done for us. First, they allowed us to do experiments in their fields, but also for their ancestors, for basically recognizing and breeding the trait. In the future, I think it would be important to continue to explore natural diversity, because that's probably something that has been underestimated. It's interesting that people have been looking for nitrogen fixation in corn for more than 100 years. There are actually papers from beginning of the 1900s talking about this topic, and for decades people look for that. But the approach of the scientific community has been most of the time to look for diversity on the microbial side, finding the right microbe if you want, whereas here it was the idea of it was looking for diversity on the plant side, on the host, and that's maybe the future of in that area is looking for natural diversity of the plant also.
And briefly, Jean-Michel, so this corn takes 9 months to mature, is my understanding, which clearly is not very easily transferable to a Wisconsin climate. But just as the indigenous farmers in Oaxaca have worked with this corn to make it work best for them, are there ways that we can take something of this corn and introduce it to Wisconsin and our Wisconsin corn crops?
Absolutely, and that's what we have started to do, in fact. And we have started the introgression of the trait, introduction of the trait into what you would call normal corn, and we think that it basically works, that the trait is really controlled by plant genetics, and that we can breed that trait into normal corn, and that to apply that to Wisconsin, that's the absolutely necessary step.
Well, Jean-Michel, thank you so much for sharing this information.
Thank
it's
you.
Really interesting.
You're welcome.
Jean-Michel Annet is a professor in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. We talked with him about the discovery he and his team have made about a type of corn in Mexico that makes its own fertilizer. Indigenous farmers there have been cultivating it for centuries. Incarcerated people across America and parts of Canada are striking this week, pointing to what they say are inhumane conditions inside prisons.
The strike is expected to go through early September, and it comes in reaction to rioting at a corrections facility in South Carolina 4 months ago that left 7 inmates dead.
Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve is an associate professor at the University of Delaware in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. She researches the criminal justice system. Nicole, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
These protests are taking place across the country and, like we said, even in parts of Canada as well. It's difficult to know how big they've gotten, but can you help us understand why these protests are happening and why it's a widespread movement?
Right. Well, we've heard as many as 17 states might be participating, but I think the scope is very difficult to tell. And I think one of the issues is that people on the inside are often subjected to brutal, inhumane conditions, are often terrified to speak out against abuses of power, denial of food, denial of medical care. And those types of things. And I think there are some, you know, advocacy groups that are helping people on the inside voice their displeasure, voice the types of abuses that they endure. Some of the demands that they're talking about is just the quality of life that they are subjected to on a daily basis, the punitive nature of the criminal justice system, giving grossly punitive sentences for what in some cases should be small crimes that allow people to rehabilitate themselves and then go back into society. And then also the labor issues that are happening within prisons, where people are working in many cases arduous, dangerous jobs with really no promise of getting more than $2 a day for this really dangerous work. And often the salary goes back into them basically buying things out of commissary that are just basic, toiletries or extra additional snacks or things to help them not be hungry while in prison. And so this is kind of the basic thing. It shows that, you know, some of these conditions, while, you know, every state is different, every location is different, some of the issues of humanity and the oppressive nature of prisons and jails is kind of has a common quality across many jurisdictions.
We heard from Shannon on Facebook. She says that we treat prisoners horribly, and she adds the systemic inequality is as plain as day. And it sounds like those comments really echo what the prisoners themselves are saying.
Yes, and I think one of the really difficult things is, you know, when you're on the inside, you are removed from society. It is assumed that you're dangerous. You're put with a criminal label. But we know, especially in jails, a lot of the people serving time, for instance, are nonviolent drug addicted offenders. And I think it's easy to, you know, when they're cast away, just say, well, they must have deserved it. They must have done something to be there, and then not really scrutinize what's happening on the inside. And that becomes I don't know. I think the rationale for why officials and many of the sheriffs that run these prisons are allowed in some ways to go unchecked in how they run the prisons on a day-to-day basis, right? You have people that are reformers. You have people in Chicago, for instance, like Tom Dart, who are running and saying that they are reforming prisons and jails to make them more humane. But it really, the proof is in the pudding. How do people live on a day-to-day basis? And what you see is a ton of suffering.
We talked previously on the show about kind of the history of American criminal justice and incarceration, and it seems that at various points in history there has been some emphasis on rehabilitation, but that we are in an era right now where it's very, very punitive. And it seems like a lot of the demands that the people who are striking have are related to, what about when we get out? We are not getting the opportunity for education or basically to learn how to reintegrate into society.
Right. I mean, again, there's this, to me, this contradiction, this paradox, if you will, maybe hypocrisy of what reformers or in some cases officials are saying, right? Well, we provide education services, or we provide, in some cases, small little reform programs where they put 25 people in yoga and teach them meditation. But that is not systemic change, right? Those are band-aids on larger problems. And so in California, this became extremely visible when you had inmates that were in some ways kind of forced to help work on these massive fires, deadly fires that were, in some ways destroying communities. And you had these inmates on the front line paid $2 a day. Now, the hypocrisy comes that after these inmates are set free, they're not allowed to use these skills in the quote unquote real world. They are not allowed to be firefighters. They're not allowed to train. Disenfranchisement and their criminal, quote unquote, criminal label makes it so that is a job that is not able for, that they don't have access to. So therein lies the hypocrisy. If it was really reform and rehabilitatively oriented, you would have job training so that people have a future after they are allowed to be free. And I think the assumption by, much of the public is that we have that forgiveness plan, but in many cases we don't, and we don't have it even for nonviolent offenders.
We're talking right now with Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleve. She's an associate professor at the University of Delaware in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. We're talking about the strikes that are happening across the U.S. and in Canada among prisoners demanding more humane treatment while they are incarcerated. And Nicole, being incarcerated obviously means having your actions and your activities closely monitored and closely regulated. So what kind of tactics do the prisoners have to be able to show their displeasure, to make their demands, and to be on strike?
Yeah, well, I think, this really is an act of bravery, because I believe, from the work that I've done, I've studied a lot in Chicago. I was getting my PhD at Northwestern University, and I started a large study of both the court system, but I was also able to see the proximity of the jail, because inmates are brought into the court with the sheriffs right there. And you see in some ways the abuses kind of seeping into the court. You get an indication of what life might be like. 2 years ago, Illinois Supreme Court judge was in bond court and saw a mentally ill woman brought out in a garbage bag. She was arrested in her underwear, and they only gave her the dignity, if you will, of letting her wear a garbage bag. And I think, and the other thing is recently there's a new lawsuit against the Cook County sheriffs that they are saying that, the class action is claiming that they've been videoing inmates while they're in the bathroom, male and female, with guards present, and they have no privacy. So I just want to emphasize to the listeners that any type of protest, if you will, on behalf of people on the inside is a brave act. Many of them are doing hunger strikes. Many of them are refusing to work. And trust me, if you're on the inside, working is actually a way to cope with the long years that you might have. So in some respects, work is an important way of surviving. But the type of abusive practices of not paying people is, I think, what they're protesting. It's really the activist that's trying to help many inmates on the inside be able to communicate these wishes to the outside world. But it really depends on the type of correctional institution that you're in. There are some folks that have access to more, preachers and Religious leaders and activists and teachers and professors. So here, the Greaterford Prison in Philadelphia has a lot of resources. In Illinois, it's very different. And for instance, people were trying to smuggle my book into the Cook County Jail and ripping off the covers and almost using a book like contraband, meaning they're so desperate for education, they're so desperate for information that they wanted that book to be in their hands. So again, it varies. It varies about how much access people have to be able to protest. But that's why it's really difficult to tell. Is it actually 17 states that are protesting, or is the scope much bigger? And we just are unable to, in some ways, get access to those on the inside that are trying to make a difference and trying to communicate with the outside world about the plight of these conditions.
We're talking right now with Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleve about a prisoner strike that's underway across the United States and parts of Canada. It's planned to last for several weeks. She's an associate professor at the University of Delaware in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice.
And we want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about conditions at our jails and prisons? Do you want to see them improved? What kinds of reforms do you think should be made to the criminal justice system, if any? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We're continuing our conversation about a nationwide prisoner strike that's underway. Our guest is Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleve. She's an associate professor at the University of Delaware in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one been incarcerated? If so, what was your experience? Do you think we should prioritize improving the treatment of incarcerated people? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Melvin on Facebook said prisons should have self-sustaining work, such as farms with livestock and spaces for gardening. He also says luxury items like a weight room should be removed, but a library and school area should be open for a few hours a day for those wanting to educate themselves. And Nicole, one of the things I want to ask is, as you said, it's different in every state, but are there any overall requirements of prisons to what they provide for people that are incarcerated there?
You know, I mean, many of the prisons, they will go under federal oversight if the conditions don't improve. So, for instance, in Chicago, when the prison population or the jail population reached 10,000 people, they were under federal supervision that they had to downsize. So in that respect, I mean, again, there's constant, they're constantly under scrutiny, if you will. But, I you know, again, with the education system, I mean, that is kind of at the whim, the political whim of governors, state by state. And so in some states you do see, you know, in Pennsylvania, I was quite surprised when I came out here and I was able to go to the Greaterford Prison and I was able to give a guest lecture. They had Michelle Alexander and other scholars, Cornell West, and they had a really vibrant education system for even people that had life sentences here. So they could actually become, get a BA from Villanova University, for instance, or even a master's. And so to me that felt, it gave the people on the inside purposeful work. In many cases, the people on the inside were mentoring young men. This was a men's prison, on how to not come back, right? So they had a whole intervention system. So some of these men with, you know, serving life were in some ways serving life, meaning cultivating goodness and reform in their fellow inmates. And to me, that was something I had never seen. I'm so used to Illinois prisons that didn't have those types of resources when I was researching them, that you could really just see this vast difference in what some prisons were willing to do and what other prisons were, you know, engaging in vast deprivation, if you will.
Let's go to the phones, and Michael in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I just wanted to give my insight as to being a formerly incarcerated person. When I heard about the prison strike, I had mixed feelings. Like, the people that are striking, I think, will be retaliated against heavily, and it'll last a long time into their sentence that they stood up for themselves. The prison system does not want you to make waves against what's going on against you. I felt like the DOC stands for the Department of Corruption because of the way they suppress any kind of your ability to access the outside world, your ability to fight against their corruption if you file internal complaints. They will retaliate against you in roundabout ways by denying you programming and educational things and jobs. So I'm power to the guys that are standing up for themselves, but I feel for the way that they're going to be retaliated against.
And Michael, before we let you go, I wanted to ask, first of all, thank you for those insights. What has it been for you like as you came out of prison and reintegrated into your community?
It's very difficult. You know, I was a hardworking guy that got caught up with alcohol abuse. And before I let my life slip into that mistake, I was doing well. And then, you know, to be put in the prison system for, a drug or alcohol problem, I think it's ridiculous. You should go into rehabilitation programs. You should go into treatment. Any sentence that you get, it ends up being a life sentence in a lot of ways, because if you can imagine not having a paycheck for 1 or 2 weeks, imagine not having a paycheck for years. You're forever going to be behind the eight ball. I lost my house, I lost a business, vehicles, and I don't know how I'll ever recover that. I'm doing my best. I'm back in school trying to, reinvent myself, but still I have to go try and explain what I did the last several years. And it's just going to be difficult, but I'm a fighter. So.
Michael, thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm guessing, Nicole, that resonates with you.
It does, because Michael is definitely not alone. I think he sounds like a spokesperson for a lot of a large national problem, which is mass incarceration is mass. It affects all different people in society. It affects people who suffer from addiction, that it's easy to get caught up in the system. You know, if you are wealthy and have resources and have a very stable family, then your addiction will go to, you go to an addiction center, you will not be incarcerated. For other people, it's not, their rock bottom is in the jail cell. And I think I think it shows, though, that imagine being an addict trying to stay clean and then also having these social cascades of suffering, right? Losing your car, losing your home. Those are enough to push people back to addiction, right? So the system itself is so punitive. It exerts, hardships on people that almost thwart their actual recovery. But I also thought what Michael said was really important, which is this idea of retaliation. One of the key issues that jails and prisons have is that they don't have oversight, is that the rank and file sheriffs are not are basically able to use their discretion as they see fit. That means putting people into solitary that complain. That means giving people, not denying them privileges to go to the law library or denying them privileges to call home. These things can be, deadly in some cases. In Cook County, the jail, there was a man that had, a medical condition, and he wasn't able to sleep on the top bunk, and he had a seizure. The medical team had said, do not put this man on the top bunk. And for some reason, the sheriff's officers thought it would be either funny or would be punitive to put him on that top bunk, and he was paralyzed for life. His entire life was changed. So I want to echo Michael's concern about, the folks protesting on the inside right now, there's nothing short of a heroic act of bravery, because there will be repercussions in many cases on these men and women who are doing this. It's not forgotten. Even sometimes complaining or asking for medication could be cause for sheriffs to retaliate against an inmate. And even asking to be treated just with that basic level of dignity can be dangerous. You can imagine that a strike would be much more concerning.
We're talking with Nicole Gonzalez-Van Cleve about the current prison strike that's going on across the United States and in some Canadian provinces as well. Let's go back to the phones, and Anne in Amory is up. Hi, Anne.
Hi there. I already spoke with somebody, but I'm on again. That's great, because I have a friend who's been an inmate at Peshitta Correctional Institution in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin now for 18 years, and I have so many horrific stories to share with the public, but it would just take way too long.
Why don't you just give us maybe one story that really kind of illustrates it for us, Anne?
Well, that would be very good to do. What I would like to it's just, it's it's a cascade of things. It's the food has been the inmates don't prepare the food anymore. It's jobbed out, and the portions are so small, and then they have to work a couple of days. If they're lucky enough to get a job, that only pays just a minimal amount of money. And as you explained earlier, $2 a day doesn't even cover what she's getting.
And we're getting a little short on time. I want to ask Nicole, do we see different issues for women who are incarcerated versus men?
You know, for women who are incarcerated, you know, the issue to me is that they often have children. And so many of the decisions they're making on the inside has everything to do with them trying to be great parents on the outside. And imagine how difficult that is, right? So, many female inmates, it can be very difficult because guards know how important those visits are with children, and those can be used against them. And so they are very vulnerable to victimization on the inside. And what many people have to remember, too, is if you do go onto the route of the criminal justice system, a lot of times people are victims of trauma. And so we are more able to fault people on the inside and think of them only as defendants, offenders, using those types of terms. We rarely see that a lot of times the failed child care system, child welfare system, school system, many female prisoners have been victimized. And so that is their route. That is their route either to addiction or types of criminal behavior to express that victimization. And so, you know, to me, that is kind of the plight of the female prisoner. It is very difficult. And I can imagine, too, that in striking, they could be even more vulnerable to different types of abuse by prison guards.
Ellen on Facebook wrote saying that access to things like a shower, toilets, and 3 square meals a day should be all taxpayers need to provide. And briefly, because we're getting a little short on time, Nicole, how would you respond to that idea that, you know, prisoners are there for a reason and they should feel like they're being punished?
Right. You know, again, I think it's a balance, because if we talk about, you know, punishment fitting crimes, right, how are we supposed to have a criminal justice system that holds people accountable? The issue, though, is that what we're not seeing is the problem of exploitation, right? And so when we say that we're giving people basic necessities, no, most prisoners have to go to a commissary to get soap and shampoo and other types of supposed luxuries, right? These are just basic things people need to live and stay clean. And so, you know, we have to think about the system as, are we incarcerating people for life after one offense or small offenses, or are we trying to really rehabilitate people so that we will never have them in the system again?
Nicole, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleve, associate professor at the University of Delaware in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice. She joined us to talk about the current prison strike.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we look at the idea, while technology can be a good tool for education, arguments can be made against screen learning.
And several Wisconsin counties have referendums on the ballot this fall to gauge public support for both medicinal and recreational marijuana. We'll ask whether you support that or not in your county, and whether there should be a statewide marijuana policy that suits all.